From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the US High Court rules to allow Hobby Lobby to exclude birth control from their employees' health coverage.
Today's ruling was profoundly disappointing and actually quite outrageous because it singles out a very important form of preventive health care service that women use.
Also today, we're in Israel as the bodies of three missing teenagers kidnapped earlier this month are found in the West Bank. And our correspondent reports from Iraq as the Islamist insurgents group ISIS continues its rebel takeover.
Everyone here has relatives in more dangerous parts of the country. Mosul is just a 90-minute drive from here too. So the crisis is being very keenly felt here nonetheless.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The bodies of three Israeli teenagers who went missing in the West Bank earlier this month have been found in a village near Hebron, according to the Israeli army. They disappeared while hitchhiking home, and Israel has accused Hamas of involvement in their abduction. Hamas denies responsibility, but journalist James Marlowe in Jerusalem says the Israeli cabinet may now authorize a military response.
It's clear that there's going to be now even a further clampdown now on Hamas, the militant Islamic group. They may fire back many, many more rockets from Gaza as they've been doing for the last few days. There could be a full invasion now into Gaza to root out some of the arms and the rockets which Hamas are storing up inside of Gaza.
Fighting has continued between Sunni extremist rebels and Iraqi government forces around the northern city of Tikrit. Iraqi troops have been trying to retake Tikrit after it was taken by ISIS-led militants on the 11th of June. Ali Barrett reports from Erbil in northern Iraq.
Fresh airstrikes have been carried out around Tikrit, and local witnesses report former President Saddam Hussein's palace is among the buildings that have been hit. Iraq's army is denying that rebels drove back a convoy coming to the aid of a nearby military base as parts of it were seized by militants in a counterattack. The Iraqi military launched a major offensive on Tikrit at the weekend after its soldiers recaptured part of the campus of Tikrit University on Friday. The continuing clashes in and around the city come after ISIS militants declared an Islamic caliphate in the territory they control in Syria and Iraq. Iraq's parliament is due to meet on Tuesday to try and elect a new government after elections in April.
The White House says the U.S. Supreme Court is putting the health of American women at risk after a ruling that U.S. companies can claim a religious exemption to laws requiring them to pay for their employees' contraception. Critics of the court's decision say that it opens the way to a series of challenges to other American laws. Here's Simon Marks from Washington.
In one of the most significant Supreme Court decisions for years, the justices ruled by 5-4 that the management of a private company cannot be compelled to pay for their workers' contraception if they have a religious objection to it. In a country in which millions of Americans rely on company-funded healthcare plans, it is an enormous issue, and White House spokesman Josh Earnest says a regressive decision.
President Obama believes that women should make personal healthcare decisions for themselves, rather than their bosses deciding for them.
The ruling has potentially enormous implications. It's the first time the Supreme Court has taken the view that a private corporation can hold religious views.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Talks are underway in Brussels to determine the next steps in solving Ukraine's separatist crisis. Clashes in East Ukraine are continuing despite the EU handing down a Monday deadline for Russia to convince pro-Russian rebels to back down. Sandra Gatman reports from Brussels.
European officials are contemplating when to unleash a third wave of economic sanctions against Moscow as Russian authorities fail to display signs of helping to de-escalate separatist movements in East Ukraine. Clashes with Ukrainian government forces have continued despite the presence of a ceasefire expiring on Monday. EU leaders also gave Russia a Monday deadline to convince rebels to give back taken checkpoints, hand over hostages, and implement an agreed peace plan with Kiev. French President François Hollande, together with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, engaged in a two-hour-long phone call on Sunday with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
The Australian-born, British-based entertainer Rolf Harris has been found guilty of 12 counts of indecent assault. The 84-year-old has been convicted of a string of sexual abuse charges dating between 1968 and 1986. Dan Whitehead reports from London.
During a six-week trial, the court in London heard evidence Mr. Harris attacked four victims, including the 13-year-old best friend of his daughter, Bindi. Other victims included a girl who said Harris groped her when she was aged 7 or 8 after she went to get his autograph at a community centre near Portsmouth. The prosecution described him as being a sinister pervert with a dark side. Mr. Harris, who denied the allegations throughout, has been released on bail but will return to court on Friday to be sentenced. He's been told to expect a custodial sentence.
For the rest of the day's news, you can follow us on Twitter at Feature Story or check out our new website at featurestorynews.com. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
President Obama believes that women should make personal health care decisions for themselves rather than their bosses deciding for them. Today's decision jeopardizes the health of women who are employed by these companies.
The reaction of the Obama administration to today's highly anticipated U.S. Supreme Court ruling that some private businesses do not have to pay for contraceptive coverage for employees based on religious grounds. Today's 5-4 decision deals a blow to the birth control mandate in the healthcare reform law. Hobby Lobby challenged the requirement, arguing that it violates religious freedom. The mandate in the law applies to companies with 50 or more employees. The High Court's limited ruling applies to closely held companies, which are private, family-owned businesses. Julie Gonan is the Director of Government Relations at the Center for Reproductive Rights.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court issued an opinion in two related cases, both of which involved challenges under the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act requires that employers that have 50 or more employees provide health insurance and that that health insurance covers certain minimum things, including preventive health care. The law requires that that preventive health care include contraception for women. These particular employers objected to covering in their health insurance plans certain forms of contraception for women, so they sued the government seeking to be exempted from that coverage requirement. And today the Supreme Court sided with those companies and decided that they did not, in fact, have to cover certain forms of contraception in their health insurance plans.
And what does this mean in terms of women's health coverage and the broader question over the rights of women? How significant was today's ruling?
I think that today's ruling was quite significant, and it was profoundly disappointing and actually quite outrageous because it singles out a very important form of preventive health care service that women use for special treatment, and I don't mean special in a good way. What it basically said is if the owners of a for-profit company object to certain forms of birth control, they can simply deny coverage for that birth control in their health insurance plans, even though the law generally requires employers to cover these services. It means that women who work at companies whose owners happen to have different religious beliefs from their own will be blocked from having their birth control benefits covered by insurance. And this is particularly important for some of the more effective methods of birth control. Some of the longer-acting forms, like IUDs, are the more expensive forms. So the Affordable Care Act represents a great step forward for women's health, but today's decision undermines that promise to an extent that we don't fully understand yet.
Those who support that 5-4 ruling at the Supreme Court today have argued that deeply held religious beliefs have now effectively been recognized as more important than the demands of the government.
Well, I think that the pitting religious beliefs against women's right to access contraception is really sort of a false opposition. The owners of these companies themselves are free to make their own personal health care decisions and not use any form of contraception to which they have a religious objection. But now the women who work for those companies are being denied their ability to follow their own consciences and their own religious beliefs in making the healthcare decisions that are best for them and their families. So this really allows bosses to impose their religious beliefs on their employees and deny them coverage for important healthcare services.
One Democratic pollster, Anna Greenberg, said even though this decision was a court decision and not Congress, it will still be seen as part of the broader narrative of the war on women. Did you agree with that?
As you point out, this is a decision coming from a court, so it's not officially the opinion of a particular party. I think mostly our organization is simply concerned about women having access to these essential healthcare services. It does fit into a broader narrative that we've been seeing over the last few years of attacks on women's reproductive healthcare services, and it is, in that regard, very troubling. Again, it's just very disturbing that only a healthcare service that women need and that they need in order to make very important fundamental healthcare decisions for themselves and their families are being singled out for this treatment. The court indicated that companies would not be able to use their religious beliefs to deny other kinds of healthcare services. And while that's certainly a good thing because we don't want anybody having healthcare services denied, it's hard to understand a logic whereby only something that women need can be denied for religious reasons, but nothing else can. And that's what we find so problematic about this decision today.
Julie Gonan, Director of Government Relations at the Centre for Reproductive Rights. This is FSN Reports. The Israeli government has held an emergency cabinet meeting after the bodies of three missing teenagers were found near Hebron in the West Bank. The three boys disappeared earlier this month as they hitchhiked home. Their bodies were found in the village of Halhul, and an Israeli military operation is reportedly underway to seal off the area. The Israeli government has blamed Hamas for their abduction, though the militant Palestinian organisation has denied responsibility. Yaakov Lapin is a defence correspondent for the Jerusalem Post.
Security forces, accompanied by civilian volunteers, were carrying out searches in an open field northwest of Hebron this afternoon when the bodies were discovered. They were not buried, they were in a field. And they were discovered. Crime scene investigation officers from the police were called to the scene, and the bodies were then identified as those of the three abducted teenagers who were kidnapped and brutally murdered. According to Israeli evaluations, shortly after the kidnapping, the three teenagers were murdered by the two kidnappers who came from the Hamas organization in Hebron.
There are reports from Israeli security sources that there is going to be a full military operation against Hamas in Gaza and the West Bank. Can you tell us anything about that?
I think that's premature. I think that one of the things that the Israeli security establishment is still seeking to ascertain is whether this kidnapping was ordered and orchestrated by Hamas in Gaza or whether it was carried out by a local Hamas cell operating in the West Bank, and we still have not heard news about that. What we do know for a fact is that Hamas in Gaza has been calling for and inciting for the kidnap of Israeli civilians for well over 3 years now, and they have supported that act in every way that they can, and Hamas in Gaza has been caught over the past 3 years attempting to orchestrate kidnappings such as these. Whether or not that means that an operation will take place in Gaza or not, I think it's too soon to know. But what I would say and what I would stress is that over the past week, southern Israel has been under relatively heavy rocket attack from the Gaza Strip. Well over 50 rockets have landed in the areas of southern Israel that have been fired from Gaza, and that is adding to the tension in the region at the moment.
assuming that Hamas are found to have played some role in this, and I hear what you say about the different versions that there might be, assuming they are found to have played some role, I mean, it's inconceivable the Israeli government won't react with some form of military action, I would say.
I would agree. It's inconceivable that the government would not respond to the kidnap and murder of three of its civilians. I would also say that over the past 2 weeks, we've already seen the beginning of a response. Something like 300 Hamas members have been arrested across the West Bank, and the Israel Defense Forces have been busy making those arrests, seizing weapons from Hamas weapons hideouts in the West Bank, and operating against Hamas on a daily and nightly basis. The problem is that Hamas's major area of activity is in the Gaza Strip. That's where they've amassed almost 10,000 rockets and missiles, which they're pointing at the Israeli home front. And that is really the center of gravity for Hamas. So really the question is whether this will spread from the West Bank to the Gaza Strip. And again, I think it's too soon to know the answer to that question.
Yaakov Lapin, defence correspondent for the Jerusalem Post, talking there to Ian Dale of Britain's LBC Radio.
It's important in all of this to see that the majority of the population probably share the views that we're expressing. It's not too late in the sense that there are a lot of his fellow Shia who want to see a proper unity government. Ayatollah Sistani, who's the leading Shia cleric in Iraq, has called for a government of national unity. He is by far and away the most influential person on the Shia side. There are Sunni groups, there are the Kurds, of course, who are prepared also to come together. So it's not hopeless, but it is urgent.
Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair giving his assessment of the jihadi offensive in Iraq during his interview with Yahoo News today. The Islamist militant group ISIS says it's creating an Islamic State, or caliphate, on territories it's gained control of in Syria and Iraq. It comes as Iraq's army continues an offensive to retake the northern city of Tikrit from the ISIS-led rebels. Earlier, I spoke to our correspondent Ollie Barrett, who's in northern Iraq, and began by asking what life is like there as the crisis unfolds.
It's remarkably normal feeling, actually. The shopping malls are open and doing business. It's Ramadan, so the restaurants are quiet in the day but fill up in the evening. There is no great sense of unease in this city. Erbil has always been very well secured by the Kurds. There have been hardly any of the type of suicide bombings here since the Iraq war that are seen on a daily basis elsewhere in the country. Impacts are being felt, though. Petrol, for example, is in short supply. There are long queues at gas stations for it. Refugees continue to flood into Kurdistan, and that is becoming an increasing strain for Kurdish authorities, who were already dealing with an influx of refugees from Syria. And no matter how safe Erbil is, of course, as a city, everyone here has relatives in more dangerous parts of the country. Mosul is just a 90-minute drive from here too. So the crisis is being very keenly felt here nonetheless.
And how significant do people in Iraq feel is the establishment of the ISIS caliphate?
Well, many did expect that it would come sooner rather than later. It had to, in a sense. It was the logical next step for ISIS, given its whole raison d'etre. But it is being seen as a major ideological and theological moment for many Muslim jihadists. Should they pledge allegiance to the new self-appointed caliph, Al-Qaeda may be viewing it as a direct threat to its position in the region. But also many people in Iraq have never felt comfortable with colonial-era boundaries and borders to the country. ISIS, of course, hope the move will attract even more global attention to their cause and will work as a further recruiting tool to get yet more fighters travelling from Europe and beyond to join the cause in Iraq and Syria, which they clearly want to portray as now registering real, concrete success.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has called for the creation of an independent Kurdish state. Presumably that's going down well in Kurdistan.
Very well indeed. It's running top of the news bulletins here. His comments describing the Kurds as a nation of fighters that are worthy of independence have been as well received as you would probably imagine. Kurdistan's President Barzani gave his strongest indication yet in the last few days that he feels the time is here for the Kurds to push for independence. That's long been the ambition. The only sticking point really for the Kurds has been when exactly and how exactly to do it. And many in the Kurdistan region do feel that this crisis represents an opportunity, but also some feel a necessity, really, to go it alone now. The Kurds describe themselves as the largest ethnic group left on earth without its own state. The West, though, notably the US and UK, who led the invasion of Iraq in 2003, insist they are completely committed to Iraq, staying complete as one country.
FSN correspondent Ollie Barrett reporting from northern Iraq. Finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, a fascinating look at World War I from the perspective of the eventual losers. Over the weekend, the world marked the 100th anniversary of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo, gunned down alongside his wife by a teenage Serb nationalist, Gavrilo Princip. Within weeks, Germany, Russia, France, Belgium, Montenegro and Great Britain had all been drawn into the conflict, with the United States entering later. Robin Lustig is a former BBC news anchor, and he's written a piece for the British news magazine The New Statesman about his grandfather's experiences in World War I. He talks here with the Newsweekly's Philip Morn.
His story was that he already was 40 by the time the First World War started. He was therefore a bit old to be called up, and he wasn't called up immediately. He ran a small textiles business at the time and thought that he might escape the war, but it was not to be. And in 1916, he was indeed called up, quite happy to do his duty, I have the impression. He was a proud German. He was a non-practicing Jew, but at that time, that really wasn't as relevant as it was to become much later. So he joined the army, and from his memoirs, which I have read, it appears that he didn't have too bad a time of it. Most of his accounts about how he managed to get a bit of extra leave and go home to see his wife and family. And as I say, wasn't too bad all in all.
Was that because he was in his 40s, do you think?
Yeah, he was already 41. The German army had a special category called old gentlemen.
Oh, nice.
And he was an old gentleman, so I think they looked after him. He also developed a rather unpleasant skin condition on one of his legs, which meant that he had to receive medical attention and smear his leg with ointment all the time. So he wasn't in great physical shape. So I don't think they thought he was great cannon fodder. They weren't going to send him to the trenches. But he did his duty. He was in a sort of back room capacity, and did what he was told to do.
And how did you piece this story together? Because I understand you didn't actually meet your grandfather.
I never met my grandfather. He died before I was born. But he did write his memoirs during the Second World War, when he'd already had to leave Germany, because although he'd never practiced Judaism, Hitler regarded him as a Jew, and life became very uncomfortable. And here my grandmother actually managed to escape from Germany after the beginning of the Second World War, in fact, in 1940. And they spent the years of the Second World War in Portugal, where one of their daughters was living. He whiled away his time by writing his memoirs, and they are a wonderful resource. And part of his life story, of course, was his experience in the First World War. I don't read German, but with great foresight, my father and his elder brother, my uncle, decided about 30 years or so ago that they would translate their father's memoirs into English, because none of their children, none of my generation, spoke German, and they thought these memoirs were worth reading for successive generations. Very fortunately, from my point of view, a few months ago, my dad and I were talking about all of the comment that was coming about the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the First World War, and my dad said, "Do you think anybody would be interested in what your grandfather wrote about it?" So I said, "Well, I'll have another read and I'll see." And I read it, and I thought it was absolutely fascinating.
It is. You have quite a few quotations in your piece from these memoirs. And I think what's most staggering is that he's writing this sort of in exile, and yet he still manages to write about Germany in this incredibly sort of perceptive and even-handed way.
He does, and he writes as a man who, although he had, as you say, been exiled from his homeland, who had been told by the Nazi regime that he was not to be regarded as a German, he was still a proud German nationalist in his own eyes. He thought of himself as a German, and when he looked back at the events leading up to the First World War, he saw them through very German eyes. He did not believe that the First World War was Germany's fault. On the contrary, he says in terms, it was England's fault. England was jealous of Germany's commercial rise. It was providing more and more competition for the English, as he called them, the British, as we would call them, and that the war therefore owed its origins to commercial interests.
Your grandfather did not see the Kaiser as being in any way a kind of a sort of imperial leader. He was defending sort of German interests.
He was defending German interests, and he's got this rather sweet line, my grandfather, where he says that Kaiser Wilhelm was a romantic. His enthusiasm for the sea and the navy were more romantic than political in nature. I admit he would have liked to have more colonies, but he wouldn't have gone to war to obtain them. Even less did he have territorial ambitions on the continent of Europe. He sounds terribly sympathetic towards the Kaiser.
Mm. And you wonder if maybe sort of more memoirs, more kind of reading on the German side of things might actually enrich the discourse in Britain. Because, I mean, do you feel that discussion of the First World War is often terribly Anglo-centric?
I suppose inevitably it is. I mean, it is inevitable that on this 100th anniversary, people will be most interested in what was being said, what was being done here in this country. But it is valuable, I think. I certainly found it fascinating to have this little insight into what one very ordinary German felt about the First World War, and even many years later, after circumstances had changed hugely, still felt that Germany had been the injured party.
Did his war record sort of proffer on him any kind of any advantages when Hitler came to power? Was there any, you know, did he have any medals he could sort of...
Well, I'm not sure if he had any medals, but there is a very nice line in his memoirs where he refers to the fact that anybody who had fought on the front line in the German army during the First World War was called a Frontkämpfer, a fighter on the front. Mm. And for German Jews who were entitled to call themselves this, for a brief period in the early days of the Nazi regime, it did confer on them some privileges. They were actually exempt from some of the first anti-Jewish laws. And my grandfather thought this was really rather odd. He said, let me quote, "I'm pleased that the Führer has expressly acknowledged the fact that I fought at the front by awarding me a special medal, and that he has thereby compromised himself." In other words, the whole Nazi philosophy based on the idea that Jews weren't real Germans. On the other hand, here were German Jews who'd fought in the German army and for a time at least were being recognised as German heroes.
Robin Lustig, the now retired BBC news anchor, talking there to Philip Maughan of The New Statesman. And you can read Robin Lustig's article about his grandfather in the June 27th edition of the magazine. The details are online at newstatesman.com. I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can always email us reports@featurestory.com and follow us on Twitter. We're there, @featurestory. Coming up on Tuesday, after more than three decades since their last live show, the cast of Monty Python, the British comedy troupe, are making a comeback.
We just laugh a lot when we're together, and we always have. I mean, we laugh more. I think when we have dinner together, we laugh more than we ever do at any other time of our lives.
When we're separate, we don't really like each other, so it's very hard to get together. But then when we do, it's rather surprising that we may not like each other, but suddenly we're very funny together.
That's Tuesday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.